to you across the ether at the speed of light. It's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells and Kerry Deese of Preferred Financial. Join us for the next hour as we take a look at how your mortgage closing will go, what to expect after you move in. Kerry, for a lot of borrowers, closing their mortgage transaction is both exciting and intimidating. So today we're going to talk to our audience about what to expect at closing, a little bit prior to closing, and then a topic that we don't cover very often, but how your mortgage will actually be managed after you close. So I hope you find some of the information useful. We're going to talk about preparing for your closing first. You know, you've already been through the ringer getting your loan approved and underwriting. You've gone through all the hoops to meet all the conditions of underwriting. You've explained for the 15th time why a deposit was in your checking account and how it got there and where it went from there and how it came back in there. And you're just about ready to close. So we go from the frustrating time to the panic time now. Time to prepare for closing. And Kerry, just some last-minute things that need to be done. And from your vantage point of processing loans, some of the things the borrowers need to be aware of so that their closing goes smoothly and happens on time. What's the decision they need to make that we get hung up a little bit at the end on before they close?
It's the final decision on the insurance.
Yeah, your homeowner's insurance. You're going to need homeowner's insurance. You need to decide who is going to provide that insurance. And then, Kerry, for us to validate the insurance, what do we have to get?
A declarations page that includes all the coverages, the premium, and what's called the mortgagee clause.
That's right. It's really the insurance binder, and we'll talk about what it binds. But it basically is the insurance company promising that at the point the deed is transferred, their insurance will go into effect. And it's a technical piece of paper we have to have before your closing package can be released. But because insurance companies sometimes take a few days to get these back to us, we don't want to wait till the last minute to decide on insurance. So earlier in your loan process, while you're still maybe even in underwriting or meeting conditions, it's time to make that final determination about your homeowner's insurance, and let us know who the agent is and who we need to contact. We take care of getting the binder for you because, as Kerry indicated, it has to have the right information on it, has to have the mortgagee clause, which is the clause protecting the lender's interest in the property if it's damaged or destroyed in a firestorm. So very important you make that decision early on. And we want to talk about some things that aren't necessarily loan-related but are things that you need to do to get ready for closing. Some things you might not think about. So, for instance, on the house that you're buying, when you move in, you definitely want some electricity in there, and you want some water in there, and you may want some natural gas if you've got gas heat. So, really critical to your moving in is long before you actually close on your transaction, have the utilities set up to go in so that they're active on the day that you take possession of the house so you don't end up in a dark house with no water to take a bath in. Now, in addition to transferring the utilities or getting utility service at the address that you're going to, the house you're buying, you don't want to forget to cancel the utilities at your old address. So if you're selling your house, no use providing free utilities for a couple of months for them before you realize you're getting double billed. Or if you're vacating an apartment that you've turned over a fully functioning electrical system and water system to the new tenant that goes in, make sure you cancel the utilities at your old address. And then, Kerry, what's the next step people need to do just not to forget to do these things as they're moving?
Set up your mail forwarding with the post office so your mail isn't still going to the old address.
That is really important. And for even a more important reason, you need to not only forward the existing mail, but we don't want you to miss out on payment of any bill in your transaction because then your credit gets affected. And even though you've already been approved for your house, and it's not going to affect that, it certainly will affect your credit scores and will affect your other borrowing down the line. So you don't want to miss a payment just because you forgot to get a bill forwarded. So not only forward the mail in general with the U.S. Post Office, but also you need to contact each individual debtor that you have, your credit card lenders, your car loan lenders, And you need to provide them with your new address so that your bills go directly to the new address and don't even have to go through the forwarding process with the post office. I can't tell you how many people, when we get explanations for credit late payments, they say, oh, yeah, that's when I moved and I forgot to tell them to send the bill to the new address. And all of a sudden, you know, we're down 15 or 20 points and, you know, that affects your borrowing rates. So don't forget to both forward your mail in general, but also call each individual creditor and give them your new billing address. Along with address changes, Carrie, what else do we need to do?
Change your voter registration.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to do that, I believe, 6 weeks before election. I don't think you can change the address officially anytime within 6 weeks of voting, but you want to change your voter registration. Well, to do that, you've also got to change your driver's license address. And that's another thing people do. They drive around on an expired driver's license, and this causes havoc. You know, sometimes you have to show your ID, and you've got a credit card with one address that you did change, and you forgot to change your driver's license, so all of a sudden they don't want to take your credit card. So just some helpful hints along the way. Change both your driver's license address and your voter registration.
And one thing a lot of people don't know is that you can change your driver's license address online. You don't have to go and fight the DMV. It's a really simple process.
I didn't know that. I am glad I didn't move lately and then find out. Because I had to go register a new car the other day. And I mean, I was at the DMV for like an hour and 15 minutes. So you can do that online.
You can do it online.
Oh,
yeah.
Hallelujah. How about voter registration? You can
I
do that
know
online.
About that.
Well, you've already saved our listeners a whole bunch of hassle on the driver's license information. You just go online to the South Carolina DMV.
Yeah. And there's
what do they do? They ship you a new card? Is that what they do?
You can, and you can get duplicate lost licenses that way.
Wow.
Yep.
Man, glad to know that. It's a good thing you got up early this morning, folks. That's the best information I've heard. Now, don't forget on your bank accounts, your checking and your savings accounts, as well as on any investment accounts you have. This could include your 401k. And this is another thing. Inform your employer that you're changing address. Because guess what? You get to the end of the year and your W-2 goes to your old address and they quit forwarding mail at some point. I don't know how long the post office will forward mail. I think it's maybe 90 days. But, you know, if you didn't tell your employer, by the way, I moved, your W-2 gets shipped off to your old address. It goes into limbo because the post office doesn't forward it. And then you don't even get your W-2.
Another thing to remember, kind of going back to preparing for getting a loan, if you've moved several times in the past couple of years, make sure all your addresses are consistent. Because if you do have a different address on your driver's license, your income information, your bank statement, the lender's going to ask about it.
Yeah,
so it's just a good habit to be in all the way around.
Yeah, anytime you move, just change all of these things. It's a bit of a hassle to do, but it'll save you a lot of headaches in the long run. So make sure you change your checking and savings account addresses to your new home, as well as any investment accounts, IRA, 401k, stock, bonds. You want all of those statements going to the right place at the right time so you get them on time. And don't forget your employer so that your paycheck and W-2 has your new address on it. Now, all of those things you might want to take care of within the last, 12 or 15 days before you move. Certainly, you want to put all these things in motion. And by the way, if you don't remember this list, we'll have this today's show on our podcast on our website. Carrie, tell them how they can access that.
That is at www.preferredfinancialgreenville.com.
Or, hey, if you don't want to go to that trouble, just email me and I'll shoot you a copy of our program notes. And it'll have this little reminder list. Now, after we've done all these things, we begin to get down to the wire, down to the actual closing, what we call the last 3 days, which is kind of frantic because a lot is going to be going on. When we get back off the break, we're going to tell you how to get ready for that down to the wire last 3 days before you go to closing so your closing goes smoothly and everybody's a happy camper. Join us after the break.
Thank you for joining us this morning. We're talking about preparing for closing and getting down to the wire, what to expect. as always, if you have questions, you can call us from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday at 864-235-9596, or you can just email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com.
Great. Thanks, Carrie. Down to the wire the last 3 days before your closing, a lot of things begin to fall in place and a lot of things happen. One of the mandatory rules that changed after the Dodd-Frank provisions revised how mortgage loans are done is it became a requirement that certain waiting periods be instituted between when you are told something about your loan, given conditions on your loan or rate changes, fee changes, anything like that, and when you can actually take action to continue with your loan. And one of those last disclosures is called your CD. That's your closing disclosure. And it's required to go out to you at least 3 days prior to the day that you're closing. Now, when you get your CD, you're going to want to go back and retrieve your LE. That was the original loan estimate that your broker gave you in the very beginning when you first sat down that said, hey, here is what your loan is going to cost to close. And you're going to compare the CD, your final numbers, and we would call them final, but they're not final final.
No.
Yeah. So the CD was supposed to be final, but the CD is kind of a preliminary final, and then we get to some final final numbers. But you want to take your CD and pull back up your LE, your original loan estimates, and reconcile the numbers that are there. What we like to provide our borrowers with up front is a fee sheet that just itemizes everything for what it is exactly as you're going to see it when you go to closing, so that you can tell, okay, you told me this was going to be this cost, but hey, why is it differently? In other words, you need to reconcile the numbers. There are certain things that are not allowed to change, but then in your original LE, there were several things there that didn't represent known numbers, but were just estimates. For instance, Carrie, what do we estimate at the beginning of a loan that might be very different when we actually get ready to close?
Taxes, insurance, and the number of days of interim interest.
Okay, so property taxes just can only be estimated in the beginning. Eventually, the attorney provides the actual tax information. Your homeowner's insurance has to be an estimate in the beginning because you haven't quoted it yet, and you don't know what it's going to be. And insurance can vary dramatically according to factors that are not always within your control. What the rating is of the fire department in your district can affect your insurance premium. The response time, the average response time, whether you are near a fire hydrant, how far you are from the firehouse, a lot of factors, whether you have a brick house or vinyl, I mean, a lot of factors. So in the beginning on your loan estimate, your homeowner's insurance was estimated. Now you're going to see the actual real number on your CD, on your closing disclosure. And Carrie mentioned one other item, and that is the interim interest. I find that that probably confuses people more than anything else. When you close on a loan, you are going to pay interest from the day you close until the end of the month that you're closing in. A reason for that is that when you make your regular mortgage payment every month, technically what you are paying is the previous month's interest and the current month's principal. So at closing, you pay up the interest for the month you're closing in. And for instance, if the month has 30 days like September, you close on September 20th, there's 10 days left in the month, you're going to pay 10 days worth of interest. But guess what? When you get to October 1st, you don't have a mortgage payment because you've already paid the September interest. So no matter what day of the month you close, you are not going to have a payment the next month, but you skip a payment after closing your mortgage loan because interest is paid in arrears. But the amount of interest you pay at closing can vary according to the day of the month you close. And in the beginning, it was just an estimate. Now it's going to get down to being real. There's another set of factors that could change, a set of fees that could change, but then may not. Your mortgage provider, your broker, or your bank has got to give you what is known as a service provider. In other words, they have to say to you, if you would like for us to select the closing agent for you to close this, the attorney, then we will guarantee that the fees will be X amount. Those are the fees that appeared on your fee sheet or your LE in the very beginning. it is the fees that are guaranteed if you choose the attorney that the lender wants to use. However, in South Carolina, you always have the right to choose your own attorney. Now, your own attorney may be less expensive than the service provider. In that case, you're going to save a little bit of money. But conversely, they may be a little bit more. And if they're a little bit more, you're going to pay a little bit more. And, Carrie, what would you say the average swing? I mean, it's not a big difference attorney to attorney, but we may see how much difference one to the other.
Maybe $200 to $300 at most.
That's a most. Yeah. And I would say 90% of them fall within $100 to $150
sure.
of each other. So we often just encourage you to use whoever you're comfortable with. Again, the relationship in the closing is important. We want you to be comfortable with who's representing you. So, you know, we encourage you to choose your own attorney. If you're new to the area, we're glad to use one of our service providers. And, you know, the truth is we know the good ones. We close with all of them, and some people are better at it than others. And so we give you a service provider who will do a good job for the fees that we've outlined. But we need to reconcile those with your final CD and determine whether the fees have been exceeded if you're using our service provider or if they are in line with what we estimated them to be. Now, there are other things that can appear on your CD, your final closing statement, that actually have nothing to do with the loan itself, but have a lot to do with how much money you're bringing to closing. What are those type things, Carrie?
A big one is HOA dues and HOA transfer fees.
Yeah, so when you are buying a home and you come into your broker or your bank and you sit down and you get the loan closing costs, what they are giving you is the cost associated with the loan itself. There may be some other charges that are property specific, and homeowner dues are one of those. Homeowner capital assessments, homeowner transfer fees. They are not loan related, but you're going to have to pay them. So those are going to appear on your CD as part of your final funds. Also, if you had a home inspection done that you didn't pay for, but you're going to pay for it at closing, again, that's not a loan required item, but might be a charge that you would expect to see on your CD. Home warranties are another thing. A home warranty is not required by a lender, so it didn't show up in your original estimate. But if you've chosen a home warranty and you're going to pay for it, that's going to come out of your fees at closing. So what we call non-loan related charges should show up on your CD as your final numbers. But then, Carrie, let's talk about why your CD is not your final final. Okay, certain things can change at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that might change? It didn't get there on the 3 days prior, but all of a sudden we say, oh, by the way, there's another charge here.
Mainly those would be the non-loan related charges that we talked about. The biggest is the HOA fees. I find a lot of times even the attorney doesn't know what those charges are until the day before closing because they have a lot of trouble getting the information from the HOAs.
Yeah, a lot of times you have HOAs that are actually run by an individual in the subdivision. And, you know, it's hard to get contact with them, hard to get a call back. So there can be some last minute numbers, but your CD is pretty much the whole story. Your final numbers, though, kind of like in the old days, you may not get until about 24 hours ahead of time.
Right.
We even had a few recently that we got some last-minute changes. We were 6 and 8 hours ahead of closing trying to add back to the CD. So just be aware that there may be some last-minute items to expect. Now, you've got to get your funds to the closing table. And, Carrie, this, again, I find to be a point of confusion for most borrowers. Many of them think that they need to bring it to us as mm-hmm. the lender or the broker, but that's not the case. So how does a borrower or a buyer get the funds to the closing table that they need to have there?
It's either going to be required to be a cashier's check or a bank check, not a personal check, or a wire. And a lot of attorneys are requiring wires across the
yes.
board now.
Now we're seeing that more and more. You know, people wonder why do things change, and it always has to do with fraud.
Always.
And you would think that a cashier's check, I mean, it's certified funds.
Right.
But, hey, with the kind of printers we have now, that is a simple thing to counterfeit. And that's what was happening to a lot of attorneys. People were bringing so-called cashier's checks to closing, and they were bogus.
Yep.
And deed transfers were taking place, funds short, and all of a sudden you got massive issues. So many attorneys now require that it be done by a wire transfer. Now, even though we come to you across the ether at the speed of light, And even though a wire transfer should be done at the speed of light, it's kind of like it doesn't.
Right.
It's like that email that popped into your email box at 7 p.m. that somebody actually sent around 10 a.m. We don't know where it went. It went around the universe somewhere, flew through the solar system, bounced off Jupiter, and came back. Wire transfers kind of have a life of their own, too. But in general, if you request a wire transfer before 10:30 in the morning, it's going to hit the recipient's checking account right after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But if you miss that 10:30 window, then you're going to be in the afternoon batch of wire transfers.
Right.
And that doesn't hit the checking account till after 5:30 or 5:15 in the afternoon. The Federal Reserve handles all wire transfers. I don't know what they do. They just pile them up on a computer somewhere and then blast them out. I'm not sure why it's not done at the speed of light, but it's not. So you need to make consideration for enough time for your wire transfer to get to your closing, because guess what? If the funds aren't there, you don't
There's no closing.
There is no closing.
Yep. And remember to always use the same account that you have given to us for verification, because the lender's going to check.
That's right. Your closing funds have to come from the account we already verified you had the funds in. Now, some people will say, well, look, I'm selling my house and buying my new house on the same day. And guess what? If you're using the same attorney for both transactions, that is a piece of cake.
Yep.
Because it's just money in, and money back out, and it never has to pass through your hands. But if you are using an attorney to buy your home that is different from the attorney who handled the sale of your existing home, those funds have to get from the attorney of your sale to the attorney of your purchase. That involves a wire transfer. You've got to coordinate that with both attorneys so that this gets done in a timely manner, so you don't get over to your closing and all of a sudden there ain't none because there's no money.
Right.
All right. So getting your funds to closing, we're going to talk when we get back about sitting down at the closing table, that time of really joyful time, most of it. Sometimes there's conflict, but we'll talk about how to handle your closing table when we return. We're halfway through our show. If you've missed any of what we have said this morning, we're talking about your closing process, what to expect before you go to closing on your new purchase, what to expect when you sit down and close. And feel free to look up our podcast at our website, Preferred Financial Greenville, no?
Yeah, PreferredFinancialGreenville.com.
I don't know why I don't get that right. That's a long.
Especially since you own the company.
I know. And you know, I tried to shorten that to like PFS early on, but somebody grabbed that. So I had to have a
complicated. Well, and then nobody would be able to understand any of the letters either.
I guess not. So, preferredfinancialgreenville.com. I guess I don't visit my own website often enough. We're talking about at the closing table. Now, most closings are one of the most pleasant and satisfying hours to spend. You know, you're getting your new home. And your seller is really glad to have sold the home because they're moving on somewhere else. And usually the realtors are there, everybody's there, and it's just fun, and it's enjoyable. But occasionally, a buyer and a seller have kind of crossed swords on an issue. Maybe the buyer expected a repair to be done, and the seller said, no, I'm not going to do it. And maybe there was a little bit of friction. So we often get the question, hey, do I have to show up at the same time as my seller? Do we all have to sit across the table knowing we're mad at each other? Well, fortunately, the answer to that is no. You don't have to worry about it very often, but if you have had some issues with your seller, the seller can come in. They only have to sign two things, really. They have to sign the deed, deeding the property over to you, and they have to sign their side of the disclosure that shows how much money they're getting out of the transaction. So they really only got two documents to sign. They can go in and do that ahead of time, or they can come in after you, either way. But normally everybody sits down together. You have a good time at the closing table. And once the seller has signed their two documents, you've got a bunch to sign.
Yep.
Wow. I mean, if you could bring a rubber stamp, you'd probably want to do that. I think maybe the doctors are in cahoots with the number of pages it takes to close because it can develop carpal tunnel syndrome. By the time you finish, it's about 100 documents. It just gets bigger every time I go to a closing. I think the last few have been between 80 and 100 documents. And you wonder, why in the world do I have to sign so many documents? Well, we mentioned that most of our problems in the lending industry come from fraud.
Yep.
Somebody somewhere has done somebody wrong. That'd make a good country song, wouldn't it?
I'm sure there is one.
I bet there is wrong. Somebody's done somebody wrong. And so there's a document to take care of that. Lenders learn from fraud and they learn, oh gosh, we didn't clarify that particular issue, or hey, somebody's wiggled through this one.
Yep.
So unfortunately, there's just a proliferation of closing documents. You're going to have to sign a bunch of them, so just be patient. I think most closings take around an hour to do, maybe an hour and 15. Pretty much your eyes glaze over after a while. And then, you know, the engineers among us, they like to read every document. I always say, thank goodness for the engineers. That's who I want designing my bridge that I'm going to drive over. I want them to look at every single thing. But when I'm closing a loan, I don't really want to sit there while they read everything. So maybe for you engineers out there, get your closing package before you go to closing and the night before you can read it all. But pretty soon your eyes glaze over. You just sign on the dotted line. And really, there are tremendous protections in place. Everything from title insurance that protects you against a flaw in the title to all of the disclosures that guarantee what your interest rate and your payment's going to be and all these things. They're all there. And you're not likely to be done wrong in a closing. There's enough documents to protect everybody from everything. When that deed does transfer, when the seller has signed it and your money has gone over to them, nothing can be undone easily. Okay, once, and that's why the insurance binder has to be in place, because literally, once there is the crossover of the signed deed and the received money, you officially own the house. And this has never happened in all these years, and I'm sure, hopefully, it never will. But if your house were to burn down on your way from your closing to your house, you would be safely covered because your insurance has been bound for coverage, even though they haven't received the premium. And this is why we do these things up front, so everything's safe and ready. Make sure you got your keys at the closing table, because you need to be able to get into your house. But what the attorney is going to do from here is he is going to go down and officially record the important documents in the public record. Carrie, let's talk a minute about, why is it so important that all this stuff be public information? Because some people say, well, I don't want people knowing what I bought a house for. But why does it have to be public information?
It's really what makes it legal and official. If it's public, nobody can challenge it.
That's right. It's there for everyone to see forever and ever. It's in the record. You're in the chain of title, and you'll always be there no matter what happens past that time. Now, although aspects of your transaction are recorded in public record, there are a number of things that are not recorded. So first of all, the things that are recorded, you bought a house. It will identify who you bought the house from because the deed transferred from the seller to you. So you will now be recorded as the new owner, and that will be part of the public record. The public, anyone who wants to know, will know that you have bought a house. And there's really no getting around that. Public has to know because that's what binds the legality of the whole thing. In addition, your mortgage is recorded.
Yep.
So the money that you borrowed, the security instrument that secured that loan, that is public record. So people are going to know you borrowed money to buy the house. They can, if the note is recorded, know how much you borrowed and what the interest rate was that you borrowed. Not all attorneys record notes. I kind of wish they were, because we often need that information down the road, but not all of them do. But your note can be recorded, and if so, it becomes part of the public record. Now, Carrie, tell our listeners, because it's real important, what is not recorded?
nothing that is personal about you is recorded. So no social security numbers, birth dates, where you work, how much you make. All that reflects you is your name.
That's right. And importantly, nobody sees your credit scores.
Right.
Nobody sees any of your history, credit history, job history. It is strictly, you were the buyer, you bought this house, you paid this much money for it, and you borrowed money.
Now, one thing that's recorded that you may not know is the power of attorney. And you may not, you know, want someone to know that you have the power of attorney for someone else. But that is a recorded document.
Right. And there can be specific powers of attorney that are only for a purchase transaction. That's usually what we use to close a loan. Permanent powers of attorney can also be used for people who are representing someone who is incapable of signing for themselves or going through the closing documentation. So when you walk out of the attorney's office, don't forget the keys, because now it's move-in time. Now, here's my big recommendation. Have plenty of kids. That way they can help you on moving day. Or if you don't have plenty of kids, have plenty of friends. And, hey, if that doesn't work, have a steak dinner. Let me tell you about the steak dinner. I bought a hot tub like years ago, and they delivered it, and they stuck it up on my deck. But I wanted to sink it down in the deck, so I built a deck, and I had this hole, and I had a hot tub that needed to go in a hole. And I was thinking, how in the world am I going to get that in the hole? And I realized, gosh, I've got a 19-year-old son at Clemson University, and I bet he knows a bunch of strapping, hulking football players. So I called him up. I said, hey, Mark, promise anybody that will come to the house a free steak dinner. It was like flies. I mean, I had like 10 guys. We picked that hot tub up. We dropped it in a hole. It took no work at all. And I fed everybody a steak dinner. So if you don't have kids and you don't have friends, have a steak dinner. That'll get you moved in. Don't forget your basic supplies. You know, things will be boxed up like toilet paper and paper towels and soap and stuff. Make sure you've got all that, because you're moving into your new home. Probably going to do it late in the day. And, don't forget the necessities you need to get through to the next morning. Now, after you're all moved in, things that aren't normally talked about is what happens on your mortgage and what happens to your mortgage after you've signed on the dotted line, after you've moved into your house. And one thing that happens is you got to start making payments. Well, everybody knows that. But there's a lot more involved in the mortgage process itself after you have moved into your home. And we want to discuss those things just so you kind of know what to expect, because a lot of people call us up, you know, 15, 20 days after they moved in, and they have these questions. So we want to kind of help you with those things. First of all, don't forget that whatever month you closed in, you are going to skip the next month's payment. That's good news. If you move out of rental, then you're going to go a month in which you have no house payment. That's always the good news for people, because you just put your last penny into your house and emptied your bank accounts. This gives you a little bit of chance to recover. In your closing package, that 100 documents that you signed, there was included in there your first payment coupon. Now, that's because it's unlikely that your loan is going to get fully set up with the lender in the lender's servicing department before your first payment is due. So that initial first payment coupon, you're going to need to pull out. And don't forget, after skipping that first payment, you're going to owe your first payment the following month. When we get back off the break, we'll talk about some other changes, other things that happen to your mortgage after you close.
Welcome back to our last little segment here. Right now we are talking about down payment, where it can come from. As always, if you have questions, give us a call at 864-235-9596. You know, we have people call us all the time and go, why does it matter where my down payment funds come from, as long as I have the money?
Really, well, a common question.
Yeah. Unfortunately, statistically, it does matter, and that's why we have a lot of guidelines to conform to.
That's right. Receiving your down payment as a gift actually increases the risk of the transaction. Again, it's the old skin in the game thing. If that money came into your transaction, no matter how much it is, if it wasn't your money, it's easier for you to walk away when things get tough.
Right.
And that reflects itself in the default statistics. So a gifted down payment is rated at a higher risk. So we might have two transactions we run through automated underwriting, one in which we say, could this person get a gift for down payment? It can actually turn that loan down when if you say, what if this down payment is saved and earned, it will actually approve the loan. Especially FHA seems to really distinguish that very distinctly. And so we just have to run it through automated underwriting. We can tell you up front whether you can receive gifted funds.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, if you cannot, then the solution is this. Go ahead and get the gift, put it in your bank account, and then don't go house hunting for 61 days. Because once you apply for the loan, all we have to do is look back for 60 days to see where the money in your account has come from. So it's not something you're stuck with. But let's talk about who can give you your gift. Carrie, who is on the allowable list of who can give you a gifted down payment?
It has to be an immediate family member.
Okay, and what we call a near relative or a near family member, we have stretched that where there is a history of a relationship. For instance, I think we've managed to determine that a godparent, mm-hmm. who we had some documentation, they were asked to be the godparent of a child, they can give the gift. Domestic partners, we
sure.
can use that as a means of gift. That's a relationship that is documented.
Fiancés.
That's correct, fiancés. Or future in-laws.
Right.
That's another
Actually,
one.
Actually, no, we no? did have a future in-law that they declined.
Really?
Yes.
Well, we'll have to change that on my radio show, won't we?
Yeah.
So, folks, don't listen to us because we don't know what we're talking about. At least I don't. Carrie does. Yeah, all of these things, they do get a little gray around the edges. What is clearly a person who cannot help you with the down payment is anyone who has a vested financial interest in this transaction. That means your seller cannot give you any money for down payment. Not in the form of equity, not in the form of, hey, here's cash under the table, not in the form of, here's a check, go cash it. The seller cannot participate in the down payment. Neither can the realtor.
Right.
The realtor can make a concession that lowers some closing costs, but they cannot give you money for down payment. They are going to financially benefit from this transaction. They cannot be involved.
And I do want to clarify, the seller can absolutely pay for your closing costs.
Yes.
But they cannot contribute to the down payment. And the down payment and closing costs are actually two separate things.
Thank you for that clarification. That is a good thing to remember. Now, Carrie, as with all things, there is one exception in which the seller is able to give a gift to the buyer. What's that situation?
If the seller is a family member and is selling the property to you.
That's right. You can have what is known as a non-arm's length transaction. That is where the seller is related to the buyer. And that is the only situation in which the seller can participate in the down payment by giving you the equity. And it's the only situation in which you can take advantage of standing equity in the property to use as down payment.
Right.
In a normal transaction, if you're buying a $300,000 house and you're only paying $200,000 for it, the lender is not going to credit you with that $100,000 extra as down payment. However, if the seller is related to you, they will do that, and that can be your down payment. You may not have to put any additional money into it, depending on the amount of equity being gifted. And the reason they allow that in a non-arm's length transaction is technically because the seller is related to you, they could give you a gift to buy the house that you're buying, and the money would just go in a big circle, so they just don't make it go in a big circle. They let the seller give it at closing and give it as equity. Just remember that down payment funds are traced and sourced. It's one of the rules and guidelines that has never changed in 30 years. We have to document your activity in your accounts for the last 60 days to see whether or not the money that's going in as down payment is saved and earned, or if it's come in as a gift, or if it's come from a source that is not allowable, in which case we can't do the loan.
And my disclosure here, I feel like a broken record sometimes, but maybe if I put it out into the ether often enough, everyone will remember, do not use cash. Please do not use cash. Unless you do it before that 61-day mark.
That's right. cash is not traceable, and they just the lender, if they see a cash deposit, simply subtracts that from the balance in your accounts because they can't source where it came from.
Right.
All right, so let's move on to our last segment, and that is the question that everyone asks, what is my interest rate going to be? Now, Carrie, before the crash, that was the easiest question in the world to answer. If you qualified for a loan, everybody got the same rate, regardless of their credit score. But right. That's not true anymore. After the crash, all lenders went to what we call risk-based pricing. And it does make sense. Someone with a, we used to hear before the crash, someone would have an 800 score and say, why can't I get a better rate? You know, you give me the same rate as a guy with a 620 score. Well, now that they do make your rate dependent on credit score, all the people with a low credit score say, why can't I get as good a credit, as good a rate as the other guy
right.
anymore? So somewhere in along the line, not everyone is happy. However, we live in an environment in which risk is assessed across the spectrum of the lending market. And one of those determinations of risk is credit score.
Right.
So when someone calls me up and says, Mark, what's your 30-year fixed rate today? I have to know about six different things before I can tell them.
Yep.
I need to know what their credit score is. I need to know how much their down payment is. Because, again, the lender affects the rate according to how much down payment you're making. You make more down payment, there's less risk, you get a better rate. Then I have to know what kind of property you're buying. Are you buying a single-family residence? Are you buying a condominium? Because condominiums, as a class of property, are considered higher risk properties than single family residences. So, you know, we can have an adjustment just because it's a condo and not a townhouse. And even though a townhouse may look just like a condo, it's not. And so your rate can be different between a condo and a townhouse. What are some other parameters that the lenders will adjust the rate on, Carrie?
Are you going to live in the property, or is this going to be yep. a second home? Are you going to keep it as a rental?
That's right. Again, risk. What are you, if you have financial distress, what are you going to let go of first, and what are you going to hold on to till the bitter end? Well, if you have a rental house out there, you know, you might just kiss that one bye-bye so that you can not make that payment and continue to make your primary residence payment. Again, that results in a statistically higher default rate for investment rental properties.
Yep.
And it's just natural. We're human beings. We have to make choices sometimes, and sometimes those choices are difficult, but that's what we'll do. So, yes, if you have a rental property house that you're buying, you're going to pay a 0.75% to 1% higher rate for that house than you would if you were going to live in the house, simply because the default rate on that transaction is much higher, and you're going to pay the price in a higher rate. What other types of things can affect the interest rate?
If you're going to get any subordinated financing, that is additional financing at a lower loan amount to help with that first loan amount.
That's right. Or if you're refinancing and, say, want to keep your equity line in
right.
place and not pay it off, you subordinate that balance, meaning you keep that balance, you keep that loan in a second mortgage position. But again, now, in addition to what you owe the first mortgage holder, you owe the second mortgage holder, and there's more risk in that. So your rate is going to be affected by what we call subordinated financing. Then some other odds and ends that can affect your interest rate, Carrie, what are they?
Your loan amount. That's a huge one.
It really is. And we, in fact, one of the reasons we keep so many lenders is different lenders have different adjustments for loan sizes. Somewhere along the way, somebody determined that, well, I have to service five $50,000 loans. And if I do one $250,000 loan, it's the same income to me, but I only have to service one account. So what we find now in the industry, across the industry, is that adjustments are made for loan sizes. And unfortunately, smaller loans generally carry a slightly higher rate because there's more servicing for the same dollar amount, and that gets paid by the consumer in the form of a higher rate. And then finally, you can affect the interest rate that you get according to how many points you might be willing to pay. Now, in our market, when I get a phone call from someone asking what the 30-year fixed rate is that day, what they are usually asking me is, if I pay a 1% origination fee and no discount points, what is my rate going to be? However, any given day under any transaction, you can do one of two things. You can pay additional points to get a better rate. And conversely, you can say, well, I don't want to pay an origination. I want a zero origination, zero discount point loan. And in that case, you're going to pay about a quarter higher rate than what you would get with an origination fee. So answering the question, what is my rate going to be, is not simple. Now, that should not stop you from checking on interest rates. I have people call all the time and they say, I know you need all that information, but I don't want you to pull my credit. I don't want a credit pull. Just tell me what your rate would be if I had a 740 score. Well, we can do that. If you can describe the nature of your transaction and you know within a few points what your credit scores are, we can give you a rate quote without pulling your credit and calculate some payments for you to help you make your decisions and just kind of help you chart your way through there. The final thing that affects the interest rate that you may get is the program that you get. For instance, every day, even among the conventional loans, we have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac products. They're priced slightly differently. And we throw in FHA, VA, and USDA. Those are different programs. They all have different interest rates. Best thing is, call us. We will quote you any program that you're eligible for. We can quote it under a scenario, or we can go as far as getting your loan completely approved, everything checked out, giving you a firm rate that you can lock in for free anytime you want to. Thanks for joining us this morning, as always, and we look forward to being with you again next week. In the meantime, if you have any mortgage questions, call us, 864-235-9596.